About the long delay in kicking off here today, ladies and gentlemen, there is some weird stuff going down on my computer. I don't know what it is. But anyway, welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. There's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question. When you go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, you can click on the chat room button that should be up in the top of the website there and join in the other nice, lovely people that get in there because everybody's friends here. That's the idea because, after all, there's only a small amount of enemies and a very, very large amount of friends on this world that you've got to count on. Those small amount of enemies, on the other hand, employ much more brutal tactics, much more devious tactics, employ misdirection, and also use advanced technologies that you wouldn't even recognize if you saw them. Today, my very special guest is a man of some note, because I've heard his name mentioned something like half a dozen times randomly in conversations and emails and websites and stuff like that. Never actually looked him up, but somebody, one of my guests, recommended him, so I'm about to find out. His name's Jim Fetzer. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Vinny, and you're not the only one having oddities with their computers the last couple of days. I've been driven crazy where nothing seemed to work. I get the spinning wheel, delay. I think that the NSA is employing cyber attacks on, you know, a lot of websites and radio show hosts. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all if you and I aren't being targeted by some of that fancy technology you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. As far as I'm concerned, it's a daily thing. And let's face facts here. It doesn't matter whether or not you're under attack. What matters is whether or not you can actually go on air and actually do your job. At this particular point, this technical difficulty seems to have resolved itself by the employ of a few little Vinnie Eastwood techniques and and other special things. And she seems to be going right. So even if it was an NWO attack with some advanced technology, I'm bright enough to fix it myself.
That's very good, Vinny. I wish we were all in the equally well-prepared to deal with this.
I'm not sure that there is anything you can truly do to be prepared. Just know one thing. The most important survival mechanism that you will ever purchase, own, or have near you is between your ears all the time. It's your brain. If you can think, you can think your way out of situations. If you're afraid, you stop thinking. That's why the enemy tries to make you afraid, by surveilling you, messing with your stuff, instead of being afraid. Fix the problem, and then go, ha-ha, you tried and you failed. And I think every day that I'm alive, it's a day that I've tried, and they've failed. Don't you think, Jim?
Well, let's hope it keeps that way, Vinny. They got a lot of sophisticated techniques. So we'll see.
Hey, the truth movement has immortal technique. He's a rapper.
Yes.
All right. They may have sophisticated.
Yeah, right. Good.
That's what I'm talking about. Just use a bit of humor on them, because they don't like people making fun of them. Because you know how to expose a fascist? You get them to act like it.
Well, our government's acting like it, Vinny, I'll tell you, with all these FEMA camps, with these 3,000 drones that are starting to fly over the country, with 450 million rounds of 40 caliber hollow point that isn't even permissible for use in warfare under the Geneva Convention. Some strange things are going on out there, Vinny, and I don't like the look of it.
Oh, and it's real, too. A friend of mine, fellow radio show host, he had a caller call in, and he said, dude, there was a drone following me down the highway and in the back streets and everything for about a half an hour.
Isn't that ridiculous?
You know, and this
I
is
mean, the number of Americans who are terrorists, you could probably count on the fingers of your two hands. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. They all live in the White House.
Well, that's where the real American terrorists are, yes. The neocons and their allies in the Mossad, for example. It's really a terrible, ridiculous situation we're in.
And at this point, 9 minutes and 11 seconds past the hour, I wanted to ask you a question that I ask every guest that I don't know who they are generally. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do.
Well, I grew up in Southern California. I was born in Pasadena. I graduated from South Pasadena High School. Went to Princeton, studied philosophy, took a commission in the Marine Corps, served 4 years before I resigned as a captain to enter graduate school in the history and the philosophy of science. I spent 35 years teaching courses principally in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. I've done quite a lot of publication, articles, books, and so forth, and have spent the last 20 years or so doing a lot of research with collaborative research with some of the best qualified people to ever study the case on the assassination of JFK on the one hand, where I chaired or four-chaired four national conferences and edited three collections of expert studies and produced a 4.5-hour documentary of my own. I also have done a lot of research on 9/11 after founding Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, and you can find quite a lot of my stuff if you just do a search on Jim Fetzer. And then more recently, I did research on the airplane crash that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone. I'm currently a columnist for Veterans Today, where if you go to Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer, you can find probably a couple dozen articles on JFK and 9/11 there.
There's another thing about Wellstone. There's an ad running on American Freedom Radio, I believe, about a doco called WellstoneTheyKilledHim.com or something.
Yeah. That's a new documentary from Snowshoe Films. It's extremely good. If you go to you go on YouTube, you can find a lecture I gave at the University of Minnesota Duluth before I retired. That was in November of 2005, entitled "The Senator Paul Wellstone Assassination." I also published a book about it, co-authored with Don Foreros Jacobs, entitled "American Assassination: The Strange Death of Senator Paul Wellstone." I flew a PhD in physics with a specialty in electromagnetism by the name of John Costello up from Australia to continue my research. He is perfectly situated to address the use of electromagnetic weapons, which appears to have been what happened in this case. And we were tromping around in the snow in the winter in Duluth at the crash site, picking up pieces of charred wreckage in 35 below zero Fahrenheit weather.
Wow, man.
The research of that results from that, by the way, was a very important study entitled "The NTSB Failed Wellstone" that Michael Rupert published in his From the Wilderness newsletter. But if you go to assassinationscience.com, which is one of my websites, I also co-edit assassinationresearch.com with John Costello on JFK, because he's also an expert on the assassination of JFK. But you can find a lot about Wellstone on assassinationscience.com.
What I find interesting is that no matter how old the conspiracy is, there's still stuff that's not known. There's so much that is now known that wasn't there.
Any case has ever been investigated as thoroughly as JFK, and we're still finding new stuff. A couple of my most recent articles about JFK on Veterans Today, for example, has to do with new research that was inspired by the fresh eyes of a chiropractor, of all people, by the name of Ralph Sinquet, who realized, in relation to one of the most famous photographs of the assassination taken by James Ike Alchins, who was an AP photographer, sometimes referred to as Alchins 7, where you can see the limousine in the foreground, JFK is clutching his throat. If you look carefully, you can see the small spiral, white spiral nebulae with a dark hole in the center where the bullet passed through the windshield en route to his throat. The Secret Service agents are looking around. You have Lyndon's vehicle in the background. There's the Daltex, and actually you can see the window from a closet for a uranium mining operation that was a CIA asset, from which three shots appear to have been fired, one that missed and injured the distant bystander James Tague, one that missed and hit a chrome strip above the limousine, the third of which actually hit JFK in the back of the head after the driver brought the limousine to a halt, Vinny. This is hard for people to believe, but we have, 60 witnesses who reported either seeing the limousine dramatically slow or come to a complete halt. And of course, depending where they were, the kind of obstruction and distractions, they could see part of it. But of course, the limo had to dramatically slow as it came to a halt. In fact, it turns out that there are a half a dozen or more people who have actually seen the film before it was altered and edited, or a version other than the altered and edited version that we have available to us today, which was done already the weekend of the assassination, where one, the original film, was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center on Saturday after the assassination on Friday. It was an 8mm already split and developed in Dallas film, where the National Photographic Interpretation Center has the equipment to blow up tiny, tiny satellite images for study. And if you wanted to take a film, and blow it up for study, they have all the equipment. And then Sunday, a 16mm unsplit film was brought down from Rochester, where we now know the CIA runs a secret photo lab called Hawkeye Works, where the second film brought Sunday by a fellow who identified himself as William Smith, probably a pseudonym, of course, was the edited film that was what has roughly been made available to us now. There's some speculation they might have done some tweaks later, but I think most of the editing had to be done that weekend as quickly as possible before copies started to get out.
And
so we know an awful lot about it. I mean, it's amazing that the driver brought the limousine to a halt. We have all these witnesses. The halt lasted, by my best estimate, 3 to 4 seconds. Jack was hit in the back of the head. He fell forward. Jack eased him up, was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible or exploding bullet that blew his brains out the back of his head with so much force that a motorcycle officer by the name of Bobby Hargis, who was riding to the left rear when impacted with the debris, thought he himself had been shot. And in the grass beside the limo the next day, a triangular chunk of skull from the back of his head was found. Among the alterations they made were removing the limo stop, since it was such a blatant indication of Secret Service complicity, even though we have 15 or more other indications of Secret Service complicity. This is one that was completely glaring. And when they took it out, they also removed Officer James Cheney, who was on the other side of the limousine, motoring forward to tell Chief Curry, who was in a limousine that was leading the motorcade, that JFK had been shot. So that also was removed. And Clint Hill rushing forward, getting up on the back, pushing Jackie down, lying across their bodies and peering down into what he's described as a fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head, then turning to his colleagues and giving them a thumbs down, all of which occurred before they reached a triple underpass, which means that, you know, we see none of this in the extant film. So we have really a massive amount of evidence about the way it's been altered. They also painted over the blowout to the back of JFK's head and painted in a kind of a bulge that makes it look as though...
Oh, well, we'll have to talk about more of this after the break. Sorry, Jim. It's that time. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Very special guest, Jim Fetzer. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. You can join us in the chat room at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. And I think in the second hour, we're going to start taking callers. The number when that happens is 218-339-8525. We'll be right back in just a few minutes.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed and taught us our standards have gone.
Brand new. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the most relaxed 2 hours in truth of talk radio. We're somehow, by magical artifice, a randomly foolish and cavalier New Zealander has managed to capture the hearts of copious quantities of American patriots. Bring them on here for a good couple of hours of chatting and talking about, well, whatever the frack they want to talk about. I mean, they're the ones with the knowledge. It's all in their head. They don't need to do any prep. They've been living it, breathing it, bleeding it, sweating it for years. And I'm just going to allow them to pour it on out, as I do. Welcome back, Jim Fetzer.
My pleasure, Vinny. Glad to be here.
Mm-mm-mm. Now, we were getting into JFK. Now, I was thinking that the interesting point about JFK is that it was a long time ago that we all figured out that it was an assassination, that it, you know, of some description, and everybody now knows it, right? The general populace amongst them, if you did a survey, they definitely know that it was an assassination.
You mean a conspiracy? Yeah.
Okay. And so, here's the point: everybody knows it's a conspiracy. And for all intents and purposes, the establishment may as well admit it's a conspiracy, and virtually nothing would change.
Well, they seem to have a paranoid fear of the American people figuring out what goes on, no matter how blatant and obvious it is. In the case of JFK, for example, the Warren Commission classified all the documents and records related to the assassination for 75 years on the grounds of national security. But if the Warren Commission's own report was true, if it had been committed by a lone, demented assassin firing three shots and scoring two hits, there was no national security aspect to it. So their own behavior belies their official story of what happened.
Now, that behavior, that very mindset, I can do something in broad daylight with hundreds of people watching and get away with it. There is nothing I can't do. That's a warning shot, as it were, across the of every single ship in the world to say that there is nothing you can do.
Well, I think you're right, Vinny. I mean, we had a whole succession of presidents who would never have held that office but for the death of JFK, beginning with Lyndon Johnson, who, by the way, appears to have been a pivotal player. He was the guy who had the most to gain. He actually forced his way onto the ticket in order to set himself up to accede to the presidency when Jack was taken out. There's a huge amount of evidence about this, a brilliant book by Phil Nelson entitled LBJ, Mastermind of JFK's Assassination, is out there now. It's substantiated and supported by many others who knew Lyndon well, up close and personal, including Madeline Duncan Brown, who had an affair with Lyndon that began in 48. She bore him a son, Stephen, in 1950, not his only child out of wedlock, but his only male offspring. She told us about an event at the home of Clint Murchison Sr. the evening before the assassination, where there were only about two dozen people there, but there were some heavy hitters, including J. Edgar Hoover. Madeline initially thought that this event, this party, was in his honor. John J. McCloy, our former High Commissioner to Germany and CEO of Chase Manhattan Bank, was there. Richard Nixon was there. Madeline remembered he was driven out by a local Republican leader who worked in the same bank where she was a young advertising executive. George Brown, Brown and Root Heavy Construction. When the Vietnam War went down, Brown and Root got the contract to dredge a new port at Cam Ranh Bay, even though Vietnam has many natural ports, and I'm sure it wasn't necessary. Late in the evening, H.L. Hunt, who was nominally Murchison's political rival, but was perhaps the richest man in the world and an anti-Kennedy zealot. Late in the evening, Lyndon showed up, and these guys all disappeared into a boardroom for 15 or 20 minutes. When it ended, LBJ strode toward Madeline, and she thought he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he wasn't going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. During a rendezvous they had at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, on New Year's Eve, just 6 weeks later, Madeline confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. Lyndon blew up and told her that the oil boys and the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out. All of this has been substantiated by Billy Saul Estes, who gave an interview to a French investigative reporter by the name of William Raymond, who explained that Lyndon was in deep trouble. There was going to be a vote in the afternoon of 22 November 1963 about the Bobby Baker scandal, where Bobby had been his bag man in the Senate when he was majority leader, and that it was widely expected to tarnish Lyndon's reputation and make it impossible for Jack to run with him again. In fact, JFK had already decided he wasn't going to run with Lyndon. He told his executive secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, that. Richard Nixon, who was, as I mentioned, there at the ratification meeting, was quoted in the Dallas Morning News that day as saying he did not believe JFK would run with Lyndon again. And Billy Saul observed that Lyndon had sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. You've no doubt heard about the last confessions of E. Howard Hunt, which were published in Rolling Stone, where he gave an enumeration for the benefit of his son, St. John, as to those who were involved in the assassination, where he said he was a participant but on the back bench, meaning he never got up to actually be a shooter or whatever. But he said that it began with Lyndon Johnson, Cord Meyer, who was then in charge of covert operations, David Attlee Phillips, who was the head of CIA for Western Hemisphere, William Harvey, a notorious assassin, David Sanchez Morales, who was not only involved in the assassination of JFK, but also of Bobby, too. You can find a lot about all this, again, on Veterans Today. For example, I was mentioning about Clint Hill in his actions that day. He's given talks at book signings around the country because of the publication of a book called The Kennedy Detail, talking about them. And when he talks about all these things he did, which are not in the Zapruder film or the other home movies, which have been edited to correspond to the principal, most detailed filming of these events to ensure that they're basically in harmony, you can find that on my website, on Veterans Today, under the heading of Who's Telling the Truth, Clint Hill or the Zapruder film, where I was about to mention that not only had they taken out the limo stop and James Chaney's moving forward and Clint Hill's activities, but they also touched up JFK's wounds. They blacked in the hole in the back of his head. They added a blob to make it look like brains and gore were bulging out to the right front. And they painted in the blood spray, which disappears impossibly fast. So that John Costello has a wonderful tutorial about indications of the film having been faked, which you can find on Assassination Science. And in addition, because so much focus had been placed on the time of the shooting, which is misrepresented in the film because you get this dramatic back into the left, back into the left, that was accented by Oliver Stone in his film JFK during the trial, where Kevin Costner playing Jim Garrison makes so much of it, actually does not appear to have occurred at the time. None of the witnesses reported that back into the left, even though it's easily the most striking feature of the film as we see it. And as I was mentioning before, what actually appears to have happened is that after the limo came to a halt, he was hit in the back of the head, fell forward. Jack eased him up, looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple. And then he sort of slumped over to the left. So when Clint Hill got up there, you know, laying across the bodies and all that, none of that is in the extant film now. But what I noticed, Vinny, was that it occurred to me maybe they'd been so intent on blacking over the back of his head, which a new group of Hollywood film restoration experts, by the way, obtained a forensic copy of the Zapruder film from the National Archives, has confirmed. They say it's gross, it's crude. It appeared they actually just blew up the film and then actually hand-painted this black in, you know, over the wound before they shrank it back down. I thought they might have overlooked in later frames that you might be able to see it. And in fact, I was right. In frame 374, you could actually see the blowout to the back of the head, which corresponds stunningly with one of the first findings of the research group that I organized in 1992, namely David W. Mantic, who has both a PhD in physics and an MD and is board certified in radiation oncology, which is treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy, had discovered on his first visit to the National Archives that they'd patched over that blowout to the back of the head in the X-ray. So using a simple technique from physics known as optical densitometry, he was able to calculate the relative density of the object whose exposure to radiation had created the image, and found it was far too dense to be, you know, a natural phenomenon, so that unless Jack Kennedy was a bonehead, unless the back of his head was nothing but solid bone, it was a patch, and he defined the area. He was myopic at the time, which helped because he was doing his minute measurements using optical densitometry of how much light would pass, and he did hundreds and hundreds of them. And it turns out when you define this area, and it's called area, you know, he calls it area P for patch, and compare it with what I found in frame 374, although the hair overlaps slightly the actual blowout in 374, there's a very close approximation. It looks a whole lot like a cashew on the side. So I have all that actually in that article entitled Who's Telling the Truth, Clint Hill or the Zapruder film, for those who want to follow up on some of this.
JFK's great topic, and you literally could go on forever about it. But
But the point you made before, Vinny, about it being in broad daylight, see, they stole the body, and it emboldened them because they were able to control the media coverage and all that. And I think if they had not been able to get away with JFK, probably 9/11 would never have come to pass because, I mean, the fabrication and the fantasies of 9/11 even outweigh those of JFK. See, when I got into 9/11 research, I had the benefit of having spent all this time on JFK, so I was very familiar with the extent to which the government would go to cover things up. And, you know, when I got into it, I mean, I was much more open-minded about what we might discover than most others who lacked that background.
Do you think this kind of brazen attitude is, well, basically, there's a form of mind control going on here. I can't explain it any other way, because if you do something in broad daylight and everybody sees it, but nobody sees it, there has to be some kind of mind control play going on here, whether it's through the media or a whole range of different factors being employed simultaneously.
Well, the big picture on JFK is the Secret Service set him up. The CIA military, mafia, anti-Castro Cubans took him out. There were actually shooters at six different locations. If anyone wants to see the reconstruction of the shooting scenario and all that, go and take a look at what happened to JFK and why it matters today, which I presented at the University of Wisconsin-Madison on 22 November 2011. And I even talk about who the shooters were and their locations and all that sort of thing, because we've worked backwards and forwards, you know, from the medical evidence to the ballistics to where the shooting locations had to have been and all that sort of thing. And I think if it hadn't been for them to be able to get away with this in such a brazen fashion, that it would have been something else, you know, when it comes to 9/11, because everything is so extraordinary there. The media has been so tightly controlled. There's been forms of censorship that won't allow persons to come on and even talk about it for most of the larger radio stations. It's really quite stunning.
The wholesale censorship of it all, eh?
Yes, a part of the cut. Oh, what I was actually leading up to was that the FBI then was used to cover it up. They were the sole investigative entity. They, just to give you some illustrations, they didn't ever question the 10 persons closest to the limousine at the time. If somebody knew too much, they wouldn't ask them questions about what they knew to elicit that information. And if it somehow slipped through, then they simply altered the testimony. So they had a fairly close to foolproof method for filtering the evidence. And then since J. Edgar and Lyndon Johnson were principals in the assassination, you know, they had tight control over how it was done. I mean, Lyndon was in the perfect position to manage events after the fact, because once he became president, he could determine what happened. I mean, if anyone... And think of the absurdity, by the way, of having the Chief Justice of the United States serve as the head of the investigative group if they'd actually been able to identify anyone as a suspect. And the case had worked its way through the legal process. It would no doubt eventually come before the Supreme Court, whose Chief Justice had already been compromised by his participation in the Warren Commission. So he should never have been there. Lyndon, however, was a genius at manipulating people, and he convinced Earl Warren he had to do it. He humiliated him and insulted him and so forth, so that he signed on to the task.
All right. Well, we'll get into more of this after the break. I guess Jim Fetzer, ladies and gentlemen, you can look him up at veteranstoday.com. And let's go into a break. Now, please, ladies and gentlemen, join us in the chat room of the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com, and we'll be joining you again with Jim in just a few minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. A question in here from my producer. Have you seen the documentary entitled Dark Legacy that was made by John Hankey that confirms basically all of your research?
I recall he's also talking about the role of George Herbert Walker Bush in the assassination, and this is a rather striking aspect of it, too, because... We know that he had a role in relation to the Bay of Pigs. Two of the ships were rechristened right before the invasion. One was renamed Houston, the other Barbara J. And the whole operation had the code name Zapata, which was the name of the Bush oil drilling firm, so that if the invasion had been successful, I believe Bush would have had the concession for oil drilling all over the Caribbean basin. We have some photographs from Dealey Plaza. One I found in Jesse Curry, the chief of police's JFK assassination file. This was a paperback that he published after he left the Dallas Police Department, went to work for 7-Eleven as their head of security. And it was only marketed there, where I was quite startled to find a photograph of this very distinctive, tall, lanky guy with his hands in his pocket, his head at a certain tilt and all that, George Herbert Walker Bush. And we know independently that when the three tramps, the third of whom is not he, Howard Hunt, but rather Chauncey Holt, somebody I got to know very well, just as I got to know Madeline Brown, with whom I had over 100 conversations and interviewed in 1998 at the JFK Lancer conference, which you can get on a DVD from them, by the way. It's quite a wonderful story.
Randomly speaking, so Bush wound up becoming head of security for 7-Eleven, and then
Jesse Curry. Now, what I was trying to say is, as these tramps are being escorted through Dealey Plaza, there's an odd photograph showing a civilian walking right past them, which you would think shouldn't occur if this is, you know, these are serious candidates. I think, in fact, they were the fallback patsies that if it hadn't played out with Lee Oswald, that they would have framed these three guys, who are Charles Rogers, but whom Chauncey knew as Montoya, by the name of Richard Montoya. Then the tallest is Harrelson, Charles Harrelson, Woody Harrelson, the actor's father, who was a notorious hitman for the mob, and then the third, Chauncey Holt. But this guy walks by, the civilian who walks past, has a distinctive gait, hand, ring, and all that, and been identified by no less authorities than Fletcher Prouty, who was the character personified in Oliver Stone's film as Colonel X, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA for covert activities, and by Victor Krulak, who is a former commandant of the Marine Corps, both of whom knew him well, as Edward Lansdale, who was an Air Force general who was responsible for arranging assassinations all over the world, and indeed the Phoenix, Operation Phoenix, of the taking out of all these community village leaders in Vietnam, where, I don't know, 600 of them were killed. So what's fascinating about that is there's yet this third photograph that shows Edward Lansdale waiting to speak to George Herbert Walker Bush right there in Dealey Plaza, right in front of the book depository that afternoon. So I published a piece about this. You know, I've got that one is entitled, Was George Herbert Walker Bush Involved in the Assassination of JFK? I mentioned before, but didn't complete the sentence, about how we had a whole succession of presidents that would never have held that office but for the death of JFK, and that begins with Lyndon Johnson, and then Richard Nixon, and then Gerald Ford, who was, by the way, J. Edgar Hoover's man on the commission, and who had a wound that JFK had sustained in his back that was 5.5 inches below the collar to the right of the spinal column, real shallow shot, only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger at a downward angle. He had the description of that wound changed from his uppermost back, which was already an exaggeration, to the base of the back of the neck to make the magic bullet theory more plausible after they discovered that that shot that missed and injured James Tague had to be subtracted from the official count of three, so now that they had to count for all the wounds based upon only two. But then after, so Ford was instrumental in setting that up. One of the most striking photographs from the whole assassination corpus is one of the young junior counsel, then Arlen Specter, holding a pointer showing the trajectory that the magic bullet would have to have taken if it were true. And below his hand, you can see a big patch on the stand-in for JFK where the bullet actually entered, so that a photograph that's supposed to illustrate the magic bullet actually refutes it. I have a whole study, actually, I gave at Cambridge, taking apart the magic bullet theory that you can find online by under Reasoning About Assassinations. And then, of course, after Ford, then we had George Herbert Walker Bush himself become president. Of course, if he had never been president, W would certainly never have been president. So we had a whole succession. Jimmy Carter was an exception. Ronald Reagan was an exception. Bill Clinton was an exception. But these other guys really would never have occupied the office but for the death of JFK.
So in some way, there's been a shaping force in United States politics based upon the JFK assassination and the mob that actually pulled it off.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, you had this confluence of interests of the Joint Chiefs and the CIA and the Eastern banking establishment in relation to the Fed, because Jack had instructed the Treasury to print United States notes instead of, you know, having paying a private consortium of banks to print our own money. I remember as a young Marine Corps officer holding one of these bills in my hand and noticing it had a red embossed imprint and said United States note instead of green and Federal Reserve note. It was a very smart idea. And the Fed has cost us no end of financial misery. I mean, it's completely disgusting. I mean, this is where Ron Paul has been far ahead of any other candidate and has also, may I say, the only sane foreign policy among all the candidates we've been seeing coming and going on either side of the aisle, because Obama has really not shown a lot of enthusiasm for reducing our American presence abroad. I mean, Ron Paul would want to bring home all the troops, end the wars, you know, cut off foreign aid. A brilliant idea, by the way. Israel has really been the cause of much of our misery and dominates our foreign policy. And when scholars seek to expose it, even if they're from Harvard and the University of Chicago, they turn out to be the targets of all kinds of attacks for being anti-Semitic and so forth, when what they are doing is simply exposing the role of the Israeli government in controlling American foreign policy, which has nothing to do with Judaism or the religion of the people, and therefore can't possibly be a form of anti-Semitism, but that's such a convenient political club to use these days that it's used all the time. The ADL even had an attack that included me and Gordon Duff and Kevin Barrett and others who write for Veterans Today, where Gordon Duff is the senior editor, because we talk about Israeli involvement in 9/11, and I'm sorry to say, but it's really quite clear that Israel was involved in 9/11, and I believe a part and parcel of that was because it's difficult for Americans to plan an event like the destruction of the Twin Towers to kill other Americans.
Yeah, yeah. If it's not a hot dog eating contest, Americans can't organize it.
That's good, Vinny. I like that.
Yeah, and if it involves killing innocent people, the Israelis are the ones you got to look at.
I think it's true. I think it's true. Yeah. And the Mossad, of course, is a brilliant intelligence operation. But I tell you, when you look at, you know, the situation in the United States today, it's really frightening, in my opinion. And, of course, we have all this contamination of the world, the pollution. You know, I interview experts on radiation, Fallujah, Fukushima, and all that. And one of them is Christopher Busby, who's a leading expert on what's happened in Fallujah. And he has discovered that the effects are not from the depleted uranium, but actually from enriched uranium, which indicates the United States have been using new sophisticated weapons, nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and they're causing gross genetic defects so that like one quarter of the Iraqi pregnancies are stillborn, and three quarters of those born live suffer from genetic defects, many of which are really quite grotesque. And then on the other hand, we have the catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico. We're using this Corexit was really making the situation overwhelmingly worse than the oil spill itself, but where BP was eager to conceal the evidence. And now we're getting genetically deformed fish that are showing up there, and it's got to have killed, you know, this Corexit stuff is extremely toxic. It's got to have killed, all forms of, all kinds of forms of sea life and so forth. I mean, anyone who understands evolution and the food chain realizes that once you interrupt the food chain at any level, all species higher on the food chain are destined for extinction. Well, we made a great leap forward in that direction at the BP. But now, even worse, the granddaddy of them all is this Fukushima thing. There are some 111 fuel rods are now exposed that may go up any time. The radiation exposure now in the Western country, is states of the United States, is something like 500 times greater than it's ever been in the past. And I'm beginning to wonder whether the reason the Homeland Security is getting this 450 million rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition, which, as I may have observed, is not even permissible for use in warfare under the Geneva Conventions, because they think we're going to have some kind of nightmarish, you know, scenario where all the contaminated population, you know, in the Western states are trying to move east to find some kind of refuge from the radiation. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what in the world they can be doing with 450 million rounds. We know we've got these 300 FEMA bases all over the country that are for internment facilities and that they've been recruiting for personnel to man them. That's ominous all by itself. Then you got these 30,000 drones. Well, from a military point of view, as a former Marine Corps officer, if you're going to conduct a warfare against a population, you need a detention facility for those you don't actually kill. You need surveillance for intelligence to know where the forces may be gathering against you. You obviously need ammunition to conduct warfare. And there's been an ongoing militarization of police force here in the United States as well through something called fusion centers. It's all looking quite ominous, I'm sorry to say, Vinny.
It's looking ominous and Orwellian, and we're going to start taking some callers now on the other side. 218-339-8525 is the number to call in. That's 218-339-8525. Or if you want to go to the chat room at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, you can put some questions in there. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. We'll be right back, folks. Of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, it's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You can also join us in the chat room, VinnyEastwoodShow.com. And also, the vast majority of the guests, and by that I mean at least 90% of the guests that we have on these shows, I have never heard of or interviewed before, or in most cases never even looked at their website before they come on. The only reason I hear about these people and even bring them on is because you, the listeners, send us a message through the VinnyEastwoodShow.com and just show us their website or contact details, email if you can, and I will endeavor to get them on. And that's how Jim Fetzer got here. As what we caller on the line, area code 312, you are on the air. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, Vinny.
Yeah. What's your first name and state you're calling
Bob,
from, please?
Bob here in Chicago.
What's up, Bob?
Well, is your guest familiar with the characters Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carriles?
Well, these are members of Alpha 44, as I recall. This was an anti-Castro, you know, a Cuban anti-Castro organization, and these guys do appear to have had some role in the assassination of individuals from this group. I was doing an interview with a Cuban reporter from Little Havana and talking about some of those involved in the assassination. He was saying, well, those are my people, and I said, yes, I know. And they know, too, actually. The shooter who fired the three shots from the Daltex appears to have been an anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Nestor Tony Escudero. And if you go to there's a Freedom Park in Little Havana, you're going to find a statue, one to Jose Marti, who helped drive the Spaniards out of Cuba. And the other is to this very obscure figure, you know, Nestor Tony Escudero. And if you ask, you know, why is there a statue to this guy here in Freedom Park, those familiar will tell you because he took care of business.
Well, yeah, you know, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carriles, well, both worked for the CIA. Posada Carriles did a stint in the U.S. military. Bosch publicly admitted that he and Carriles brought down that Cuban civilian airliner back in the mid-70s, you know, coming out of Barbados.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Carriles was arrested, put in jail for that in Venezuela. He was sprung from that jail later on the last day in office of, I forget her name, the president of Panama. He was in Panama to try to kill Fidel when he went to some meeting of the Organization of American States or whatever it was. They sprung him from there and came on a yacht to Florida, entered the U.S. illegally, and nobody can touch him. He walks around today in Miami. He's in his mid-80s, and he walks around in Miami with impunity. He gets interviewed on local TV and everything else, and a lot of Latin American sources suspect that he's a surviving living shooter.
Well, I don't... you mean from JFK?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
85, 86 years old.
Well, I have a pretty good idea who the shooters were. The guy who shot Jack in the back was firing from the top of the county records building. It appears to have been a Dallas deputy sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford. I mentioned, you know, Nestor Tony Escudero firing from the Daltex. There was somebody firing from the book depository on the opposite side. No one fired from the sixth floor alleged sniper's lair.
Yeah,
but it does appear that Frank Sturgis may have been firing from the west side and fired the shots that hit John Connolly. There was a shooter who was actually a Dallas policeman named Roscoe White, who appears to have been fired from the grassy knoll, a shot that oddly missed, I believe, because although it was like the easiest shot, he was going to hit Jackie if he fired, so he pulled it. I think there were very strict instructions not to hit Jackie. The shot that hit Jack in the right temple, so far as I can discern, was fired by Jack Lawrence, who was an Air Force expert. Lyndon apparently conducted a shoot-off to see who was the best shooter in the Army and the military in San Antonio early in 1963. And I believe that's how this Jack Lawrence was selected. And then the other shooter was from the north side of the Triple Underpass. It was an above-ground sewer opening halfway between the roadway and the top. And symmetrically on the other side, I believe the shot, one of the first that passed through the windshield, hit Jack in the throat, was fired by Malcolm Max Wallace, who was Lyndon's personal hitman and killed a dozen people or more for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters.
There's one other detail. There was a documentary made, I saw some years ago, probably about 10 years ago, made by an Italian lady, I forget her name, and it was shot in a prison cell in Havana where some anti-Castro Cuban who had been a colonel with Batista had led one of these Alpha 66, adventurers into Cuba.
Alpha 66, yeah.
And he was caught. And they show him being interviewed where he is admitting to personal knowledge of the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
He may
well have had, you know, a lot of people knew. I'll tell you, Fletcher Prouty had an assistant by the name of Len Osanek, who runs Black Op Radio. It's broadcast every Thursday night, and it's a great show. I used to be on all the time with Len. But one of the stories he told was about how he kept asking Fletcher how many of his associates, you know, in the Pentagon knew that Jack was going to be hit, and Fletcher evaded and evaded and evaded, and years passed by, and one evening they were having a few drinks and talking, and Len put it to Fletcher again, and he asked him how many of them knew, and Fletcher, you know, quite somberly said, all of them.
Now, Bob, I want to thank you for your call, man. We've got to get to another call. Do you want to say one more thing?
No, I was just going to say, I think the opinion you ventured that if we, the people have been able to force out the truth about this, 9/11 could not have been pulled off.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the call. Very, very good call. You know okay. A lot about the case. Yeah.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Bob. Okay, and we're going to our next caller now, area code 360. You are on the air. What's your first name and state you're calling from, please?
Hi, this is Rocket. I'm calling from Washington State.
Rocket from Washington. Is that North Washington or D.C.?
Go Washington State, sir. The Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
All right.
Seattle, Spokane, and all that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I strategically relocated here from Texas ahead of this coming storm, gentlemen.
Well, now you get all this nuclear contamination coming from Fukushima. You know, it's a kind of a mixed bag, isn't it?
Well, you know, I bought I have actually the monitor for that, and I've been checking my property, and so far, so good. I checked my chickens' eggs. I checked the grass outside.
Yeah.
If there's anything blazing radioactive here in Shelton, Washington, I'm not catching it with my little monitor.
I'm glad to hear that. I have a son who lives in Seattle, and I'm glad to hear that.
Apparently, there's some different types of radiation, and you need different machines to detect the different types of radiation.
Yeah, that's true.
I agree with that, but I've just got an old civil defense one, and it seems to work pretty darn good. I mean, it goes nuts around the little tiny bags that go on the lanterns even. I mean, this thing seems like it works. Now,
okay,
granted, there's probably some kind of sleeper death ray waiting for me, but the reason I called, gentlemen, is I didn't have a lot of detailed information about the Kennedy assassination, but what I was going to say was a commander that I worked for in the United States Navy, he said that he knew about the 9/11 plot, like 3 or 4 months before that. And then one of his children's spouses worked in the building, and he had to spend a lot of time pressuring his son to get his wife to not go to work that day.
Oh, really?
So he knew.
She worked in which building?
She worked in one of the towers.
Oh, in one of the towers, yeah.
And it was
I had a little old lady from Brooklyn call me up and say how her rabbi had warned their synagogue not to go into Lower Manhattan that day.
A lot of
people, and of course, you know, there was this a messaging service that was warning people not to go there. There were actually articles in Haaretz and another Israeli newspaper saying that they had saved 3,000 Jews by warning them not to go in that day. Well, a lot of people knew what was going to happen on 9/11. There's no doubt about it.
Apparently, there was a whole bunch of school children and things like that talking in kindergarten and what have you about the towers were going to come down during the week in the lead up to 9/11. Like, apparently, their parents must have been talking about it around the home.
Isn't that something? Isn't that something?
Out of the mouths of babes.
Yes.
Hey, well, while the radio's still on and the electricity is still going and we can still talk to each other,
yeah.
I just wanted to tell you that all these false flags, McNamara admitting that the Bay of Tonkin was all false, 9/11, we're going to have another false flag before the election, and then whoever wins, they're going to herald in martial law. And you know, through my analysis, that's what I've come up with. And the scary thing is the end game on that is chipping.
Chipping meaning?
The RIDF chip implant.
Oh, you mean putting chips in human skulls?
And it's RFID.
Well, I don't know if it goes in their skulls, but they're talking about identifying people through chipping.
Okay. As opposed to tattoos, you get a little computer chip. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's crazy, right? So I have my granddaughter here. And I'm trying to entertain her, and I put in a little show called Happy Feet. It's about a penguin with feet that tap. It's a cartoon for children.
Yes.
And at the very end of the movie, the bird gets captured, goes to a zoo, he taps his feet, they're all impressed. The zoo people start talking, then policemen start talking, then politicians start yelling and raising their fist. And then they flash on the screen the UN symbol. And then the next thing you see is, I couldn't believe it. The next thing you see the little penguin returning to his tribe, and he's got a radio transmitter on his back with an antenna that's beeping with a red light. And the next thing you see all these men landing in helicopters to save the day. It's so new world order. It's so confirmation of the chip. They're going to chip us, man. I never felt that way before. It didn't seem, but it's the end game, man.
I guess it's more informative than a tattoo.
Hold on. Did you consider that you're already chipped? Have you got a cell phone?
Do I? Sure, I do. Yeah. Of course, I know. Those can be used as
I see it in a little deeper than that, because the reason why is my father, he has a cranial implant that treats his Parkinson's.
Oh, yeah?
And it's a wonderful device. It's a wire that goes through a hole on top of his skull inside his body, and it puts an electrical signal in it, takes away his tremors. It's like a miracle cure. He's had it for years. Oh, it works great.
That's terrific.
But you see how they're putting a wire in his brain? No problem. The next thing you know, it's going to be a wire, and maybe it'll be wonderful. It'll hook you up to the internet. I mean,
yeah, you know, it'd be great. We can all live in giant cubes and float through space.
Or it'd be an avatar in a non-real world, or go inside a robot, or who knows what. I mean, I'm hoping something good comes out of this, but there's going to be a time, gentlemen, where your radio is going to shut off and there won't be any power. It's going to go back to a pre-industrial age for a while.
You may well be right, I'm sorry to say.
Yep.
And you know, in all this talk, I'm sorry to monopolize your show, and I'll let you go. Great show, by the way. But I'm not worried about who killed JFK anymore. We all know, with JFK and all the string of assassinations that happened, and we can't trust the government anymore.
It's true.
And look what's going on. Look at the laws that they're passing. The United States is gone. We're a truck gone off the cliff. There's no time to jerk the wheel anymore. It's gone. What we thought, I mean, I've been laying in bed before, and I got like a tear in my eye. And my wife looks at me and says, "What's the matter?" And I'm like, "Nothing, nothing." She goes, "I know what you're thinking about." And I'm like, "Yeah."
Yeah.
She's like, "Do you really think it's going to be that bad?" And I just lay there, and I'm like, in my man's man of my heart, I say, "Baby, it's going to be a Holocaust. We're going to see it."
I wish I had an argument to show that you're wrong, but I don't. And I'm apprehensive that you could be exactly right.
I mean, I'm retired. I can sit in my rocking chair and contemplate and contemplate and ruminate and contemplate in a nice way. I'm a healthy person, but I keep coming up with the same analysis. The Republic is gone. People that I talk to are completely asleep. I'm seeing subliminal messages in everything, and then not even subliminal messages, just in your face. You know, I don't want to be frisked. I don't want anyone to be killed for my gas. I'll pay $20 a gallon. I'll go on record right now. I will pay $20 a gallon for my gasoline for the rest of my life if you guys would stop killing people. Stop torturing people for me. Torture and barbarism. And all those guys are going to go to jail. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Colin Powell is involved in that. Their lawyers, Alberto Gonzalez, the guy that wrote the torture memos, all those guys. We hanged people from Japan that did that crap. We hanged people from Germany that did that stuff. And there's going to be a reign of terror once the cool down, once society comes back. And they're going to be searching for those guys. They're going to be looking for them. They're criminals. They're war criminals, all of them. So, sorry to get on a rant.
Hey, thanks for the call.
We shouldn't be torturing people, and I don't want anybody to get killed for my gas. I have a horse with a saddle, and I'll ride wherever I need to go if it means that no one dies anymore. God bless our republic.
Thanks for the call.
Let's hope the Republic continues to stand strong, because once the U.S. Republic goes, it's the last bastion of freedom and hope that humanity really had to begin with.
It's something, isn't it, Vinny? And it's not good. The situation is not good.
hey, situations have been worse before, and I'm sure they'll get worse even in the caller. You've got to hold on there. So, Jim from Brooklyn, we'll come to you after the break. Rock, again, thank you very much for your call. You have yourself a lovely day, my friend, and call back anytime you want, man. That was a great, great rant, I must say, and I should know. All right, and the caller number is 218-339-8525. We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the sexiest 2 hours in talk radio on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. No, wait, let's do that a little bit sexier. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And we have Jim from Brooklyn calling in, man. Sup, bro?
How's it going, Vin?
Yeah, I cannot express how fabulous I am.
Well, I can tell by the Bob Marley coming in.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Completely. Completely. We just had we just had our 420 celebration down here, like last week. And my friend took me to go see another pop band, much like my own, called the Mighty High. So I saw the Mighty High on 420, and I'm in the Stoney Brothers.
And I'm acting under the assumption that whilst you went to the Mighty High concert, you also were Mighty High.
Oh, yes. Yes. You know what? The club was in, like, this bowling alley-type place, and then the bands played in the back, and it has all these individual bathrooms that fully locked and all had powerful extraction fans.
Oh my God!
Like they know what's going on.
This is why America is the greatest country on earth.
This was in Williamsburg, in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn. It's very trendy these days. But are you for, you know, you're into the sci-fi? You know Ghost in the Shell, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now in Ghost in the Shell, they have this. They all have cyber brains. Right.
Well, let me just preface for those who don't know. Ghost in the Shell is a Japanese anime cartoon that's set in the future where they have kind of half cybernetic, half human kind of people who are assassins and do the government's dirty work and what have you. And in this particular film, she gets betrayed and they have to try and hunt her down and what have you. But that's about it. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes. Well, they have the cyber brain, right? And I'm a big fanboy, so I have. On my wall, I have the inside of the DVD, and it says Cyberbrain. And it's a brain into which terminals have been physically implanted and whose connection to the net is supported by micro-machines. These made possible the direct, constant connection between the human brain and the net without the need for external devices.
That's so really nice.
That was on the inside of the CD cover, like the DVD cover. It's pretty cool, so I put it up on my wall.
Yeah, man. And have you noticed that we talked about how it becomes sort of in your face, as if the plans themselves and the overtness of the false flags, they are just so huge, so in your face, and so revealing that I get the impression that these people who are pulling off all this stuff, scheming it, have a very, very... innate sense of humor, a very dark and very sick sense of humor, you know, certain words, certain times, certain dates, you know, they love to see things line up and they get immense amusement and enjoyment out of it.
Oh, that has to be true because you just look at the way things are done. And it's, you know, once you've seen enough deranged stuff, you can start to look at the deranged point of view. And you're like, wow, if I was a sick puppy, that I would do that for fun. Because you see it.
Yeah. And you see it. And that's why people generally don't don't understand when you tell them that there's a group of sociopathic criminal scumbaggery elite that are trying to kill you and basically are at every point of the day or brainwashing you or some other form of nasty influence or what have you. That's basically your daily life. If you're alive today, you're being influenced by this. And the people can't understand why somebody would do it because they're not crazy when you tell them this. They're not somebody who can understand the mind of an insane, psychotic control freak, are they? How could they understand?
Well, no, because if you have feelings, you know, if you feel, if you can look into somebody's eyes and you know what they're feeling when you see a situation and you can observe because you can relate to that feeling, you know, you can't relate. It's like relating to the guy that just did 5 tours in Iraq. You can't relate to him. You can't, because that guy just did 5 tours in Iraq. He's been through hell. He probably got tricked into going there in the first place and then was stuck there because once you sign up, that's it. You know, you're now government issue. You no longer own yourself, which is why I never joined the military ever. Never will. You know, a bad idea. Look what they did. Look what they did to the U.S. Liberty, right? And those guys signed up to defend their country, and then when they called for help, the president's going, I want that ship going to the bottom. And that's,
There's so many other instances all over the place where military personnel are experimented on, given untested vaccines that result in Gulf War syndrome as a squalene reaction and all of these other terrible things that they do to the military personnel. And I'm not sure how to rectify that situation, though, because I know a lot of people in the military who served for long times and it taught them very important things, and they went on to become even better and greater individuals. Others, on the other hand, are not so lucky.
The average person in there is, you know, they're in there because they feel a sense of purpose and patriotism, however misplaced it might be at the moment, you know. But what, you know, you take this person who's basically ready to sacrifice everything for his country, and then to put them what we put them through, and then when they come back, like, just like, you know, the worst is the way the vets get treated when they're not in there anymore. Now that you've made it that this guy can't function normally, or this girl, because we have lots of, you know, in America we got lots of girls in the military, and I have to admit, when the Navy ships pull in Fleet Week, I like checking out the sailor girls. They're cute.
Yeah, well, it comes down to... ask not what you can actually sacrifice for your country. Ask whether or not your country would actually sacrifice it for you. And the answer is no, absolutely not. The U.S. government's been bought off. There's too many corrupt individuals running the show there, man. If you're sacrificing yourself in the military today, odds are it's not going to be for a good purpose to humanity.
No, not at all. But the average person doesn't really understand that. I think they're starting to. And then there's also the other point in, you know where they do the most recruiting. They do the most recruiting in, like, towns where the factory that was supporting that town is no longer there. And the town is rampant with street gangs and drugs. It's the crack towns. They're like, you know, they're like the bad neighborhoods of Brooklyn. You know, but it's a small town and it looks very nice, but, you know, they have very high crime rates because there was like one or two factories that supported that town, and everybody who lived in the town basically either worked in the factory or supported it. And when that factory closes, it is devastating and there's no work. And, you know, your girlfriend gets pregnant, next thing you know, I guess I'm joining the army so I can take care of my kid. You know, it's like that. I don't have it like that because I have a trade, but for people who don't have trades, you know, a lot of times it's like the only option. It's sad.
It is sad, and you think about it, because we just had Anzac Day as the equivalent of Veterans Day. And you just wonder, you know, how many people who joined up in the military and died actually truly knew why they were fighting, who truly knew who they were fighting, because there's been a lot of cases that I've seen where soldiers will come back and they talk about the enemy soldiers as if, you know, if we'd met together in and we weren't in uniforms and being ordered to kill each other, we could have been friends. We could have sat and had a pint of and had some beer together or something like that, you know. Why are we always fighting? It's because there's some guy telling us that we have to, and most people comply with that authority figure. I'm sick of authority figures. All my life, I've been told my language is inappropriate, that my behavior is not up to scratch, that my manners need improvement, that I need to remember all of this other stuff. Everybody's been telling me how I'm inadequate, but they don't address any of their own inadequacies.
I understand completely. I'm a total misfit. I can't be in normal situations and with quote-unquote normal people. I don't relate to them. I don't relate to them because they all, I think, you know, I was the high school dropout because when I went to school in Virginia as a little boy, I lived in a trailer park. Then when we came back to New York, you know, the school systems, because all the states are radically different. They're like, you know, each state is really its own little country. So the schools are different. I was so far ahead, and the school system was so different that, like the programming of the school system, like the way what they want to mold the child into was so different, I wound up just cutting out a lot. And then I dropped out. And when I dropped out, I took the GED at 16 to get the, you know, to get the diploma so I could go to work. And the next day, I was told you're going to go to your uncle's plumbing shop and you're going to start working. So I went. That's the way it goes.
See,
but
It doesn't matter, you know. If you've got a connection and you can get access to an income of some kind or a career of some kind, that's all you really need. I mean, look, people try to give credit to the public education system for schooling people and getting their literacy up and all of that kind of stuff. It doesn't. Literacy rates are dropping all over the place. They talk about how it's great that people now have knowledge of chemistry and Pythagoras theorem and mathematics and all of that. People don't. You ask any adult that's walking around the street that did that stuff back in high school who's never used it once in their daily life since, whether or not they can remember scientific formulas and complicated mathematical equations. They can't do it. None of the stuff that they teach you has become relevant to for the bulk of the time. Occasionally, there'll be little nuggets in there, you know, knowing how to write things properly. But as long as you can communicate using the English language, hey, how much of a benefit has it really had for you, ultimately, at the end of the day? There's something very strange going on in the human...
I think useful education stops at about seventh grade. That's when they stop giving you the really useful science. Because I'm of the belief that you could solve any problem with basic seventh grade science. If you follow the scientific method and approach your situation from that and use your head a little bit, not too much, but a little, you could tackle any problem.
Mm.
So,
in fact, that's why there's that TV show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? And the fifth graders, a lot of the time, outsmart the adults.
Well, yeah, well, because it's also when you're, you know, as you get older and you get more set in your ways, if you don't constantly do things to keep your mind fresh, it'll stagnate.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just like, you know, if you don't have any creative pursuits whatsoever, somewhere down the line, your brain stops working because, you know, your day becomes routine. You know, no matter what you're doing, if you're doing it long enough, it becomes routine. I don't care what you're doing. You're doing it for 25 years, the days is the same after, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I think back, I go, what happened to the last 10 years of my life? And I was going, oh, I was at work.
See, fifth grade science, in the case of 9/11, could have been tremendously helpful.
let me tell you, Vin. My uncle was used to be an engineer for American Airlines. Right, those were his plans. He had retired a couple of months before, and he had been in his whole life. Like, he was in Vietnam, came out of Marines. Got his job at American Airlines. He was on a first name basis with the pilots. Yeah, he had to talk to the FBI a bunch of times, but, like, you know, he didn't know anything about it. He didn't know what was going on. But then we saw it from. It was on live TV, and where I live. My area, Marine Park, you could see the tall buildings of Manhattan. You could see it from, like, you know, if you stand, especially if you go up on your roof, you see all that. It's not that far away. And those buildings were huge. Like, if I stand on Flatbush Avenue, I could see the Freedom Tower going up. Yeah. And that's going up in a quick pace. But, you know, the whole thing just stinks. Yeah, there's too many weird little things with that.
Yeah, it stinks, and it stinks of sulfur dioxide. All right, thanks for calling in there, man. It's been really nice to talk with you, Jim. And we've also got Jim Fetzer too coming up after the break. For a final segment. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to call in to talk with Jim, 218-339-8525 is the number to ring. That's 218-339-8525. You listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Segment here on the Vinny Eastwood Show. We've already got three callers, so we're going to have to knock them out. We have a very special guest, Jim Fetzer, as well, and we were kind of thinking about talking about 9/11, but we'll see. First caller is up, Kevin. What state are you calling from, Kevin?
The great state of Montana.
Montana! What's up, man? What's on your mind today?
Well, I've got a question. I'd absolutely love to ask Jim Fetzer this question. He's got an ad running on the Black Ops Radio podcast, Render Under Darwin, and it's a great book, and I absolutely would love to hear what Jim's got to say about the decline in American education, especially science education, which obviously we all flunked on 9/11, because there weren't too many people asking themselves, how can towers come down like that?
Or how can planes disappear into buildings so effortlessly without any collision effects in violation of Newton's laws? You're right. On top of it, I felt for some time that the role of television here has been quite damaging. You have a lower level of mental engagement when you're watching television than when you're in deep sleep. Reading books, newspapers, articles is a far higher level of mental engagement. I'm afraid Americans have become very uncritical about differentiating between reality and illusion. We watch too many television shows, too many movies where laws of physics, engineering, aerodynamics are constantly being violated. And we just don't seem to have the critical ability to distinguish between the true and the false. So I think you're onto something. I think it's very important and very telling, and part of why the American public has been so gullible and willing to believe what the government has told us about 9/11, in spite of the fact that it's a fantasy.
All right, Kevin, have you got one quick follow-up question?
I know. Like, a lot of the debunkers in the controlled opposition would bring up images of Wile E. Coyote and, you know, the Chuck Jones animation type stuff, and they laugh about, you know, the holes that were made in the buildings. But, you know, I keep thinking, you know, we've got a lot of controlled opposition running the debate on both ends of it, and you know, I think that Maybe Jim could answer a question here about what is the role of controlled opposition in a lot of these curriculum that the fifth graders read, where they best the adults, but then, you know, maybe in a couple of years they're not going to be able to think about science at all anymore.
Well, I think the problem with regard to textbooks, for example, in education, is that they are controlled by public groups that dictate what content is or is not included. You can't find any public textbook that has a serious discussion of the assassination of JFK, for example. And in fact, Texas has a lot to do with it because their Board of Education determines the quality of the textbooks that will be published in Texas. And because publishers don't want to have different editions of books, they tend to defer to the Texas very conservative board's decisions. And I'm afraid that's been very deleterious to public education in the United States.
Very good. Very good. Well, thanks a lot, great choice in guests, or great choice in show, Vinny. Thanks a lot.
Hey, well, I don't have any choice, man. The listeners suggest him, and I get him on. So if anything, the listeners have a great choice in guests themselves.
Very good. Have a good one.
Thanks, Kevin. All right, Lisa in East Texas, what's up?
Hi, Vinny. Hey, hi, Jim. Hey, Hello. Just wanted to get a quick little personal story about the JFK assassination. My husband and I were both really small children when he was assassinated, but my husband did his general surgery residency at Parkland Hospital in Dallas,
okay. And
his staff directors, or his staff surgeons, were the men who worked on Kennedy when they brought him in. And they used to talk about how he was shot was totally not like the government said, of course. And,
yeah. You
know, they just watched the FBI and the Secret Service totally shut down the entire normal process that they would go through with a patient and intimidate them as well.
Yes.
You know, they didn't talk in detail about what they weren't told, you know, what they were told not to say. But, you know, they had a really different take on it, being there, seeing his body, trying to work on it. And, you know, my husband always thought that was really interesting. And I just thought I'd give you a little personal account of that. The government obviously lied.
Because no, you're absolutely right. They were particularly brutal with Malcolm Perry, who'd perform a simple tracheostomy through the clean puncture wound in his throat. Three times during a press conference held there, he explained that it was a wound of entry, that the bullet was coming at him. And yet they set some FBI guy on him to beat him up mentally. Uh-huh. So when he came in the next morning, Audrey Bell, a nurse, said she'd never seen anyone look so dejected because they tried to convince him to change his opinion from it being an entry wound to being an exit wound. And I'll just tell you, I think that Malcolm Perry was never the same after that. He was a really very fine, very competent surgeon. But after that brutality and the disillusionment, I think he actually lost his, his sense of composure, balance.
We know Malcolm Perry very well, and I can attest to the fact that he is a fine individual and very upstanding. And Robert McClellan he was interviewed. Yeah, the greatest people ever meet, the greatest surgeons, and they just they just watched the travesty and were had to be part of something that's horrible.
And they were all told that their careers would suffer seriously if they ever talked about what they'd experienced there. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, you're in a historic event like that, you ought to be free to talk about exactly what happened and help others to sort out what really took place. And it was just the opposite, for the reason, of course, that the whole thing was a cover-up, because the official story was complete rubbish. Your observations are very well-founded. I appreciate the call, and
sure,
that's very
thanks
good.
For being on. Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye. All right. All right. Thanks, Lisa. Now, the Greek, welcome to the program, mate. The Greek, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Greetings. Greetings, Jim. Greetings, Vinny. If I can appeal to Jim's academic side regarding the 9/11 issue, let's maybe cite Saul Kripke when we look at some philosophy of logic, where, you know, let's say naming a necessity concerning the proper names, basically the meaning that simply the object refers to, if we just look at the simple modality regarding communication, the term ground zero has a very specific meaning. And then he also, Kripke also gets into other things where a name actually can refer to two different things or two different names for the same thing, basically leads to the breakdown of communication and a different form of thinking. So we're at a point right now where the evidence is in front of us, kind of like Judy Wood says, even though I do not agree with anything she's saying, I agree more with our Russian friend that you and Vinnie Eastwood have actually interviewed Dmitry Kalazov. And by using Kripke's simple logic that the name has a semantic meaning, the simple definition of the term ground zero, meaning formal meaning, regardless of what you believe in, creating that puzzle, let's go to the formal meaning and investigating it from that point. The formal definition of ground zero is very clear what happened on that day. Any comments?
Well, I think the government has wanted to disavow the use of that phrase because, of course, it suggests it was the ground zero for a nuclear attack. The nukes may well have been used. Actually, I've organized a conference in Vancouver that will be held 15 to 17 June that's going to address the issue of how the towers were destroyed by having representatives of alternative theories, as well as who was responsible and why, what happened at the Pentagon, and the possible use of video fakery, the fabrication of the crash sites. Anyone can find that by going to, just do a search on the Vancouver hearings, and you'll find the website. The link is www.911vancouverhearings.com. But I, when I interviewed Dmitry, I was a bit troubled because, I mean, he wants to suggest 150 kiloton bomb was at the sub-basements of each of those three buildings. Actually, the Building 7 is destroyed in a completely different way than the Twin Towers. All the floors are coming down at the same time. You have a pile of debris. You can actually see explosion go up the bottom to the side to the top, where you have that characteristic crink, so that Building 7 is a classic controlled demolition. When it's done, you have a pile of debris, or mostly floors, sometimes called pancakes, equal to about 12% of the original height, which was 47 stories in that case, so you got about five floors of pancakes. In the case of the Twin Towers, however, all the floors remain stationary. They're being blown apart from the top down. These two 500,000-ton buildings are being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, and when it's done, there's no stack of pancakes. I mean, it's simply astonishing. I had Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, who was a first responder, on my radio shows twice, and both times he affirmed they were destroyed below ground level, so that, I mean, if it had been a controlled demolition like Building 7, you should have had more than twice as much of the five floors there. 12% of 110 isn't going to be 11 plus. You should have like 13 or 14, but it wasn't there. And the reason that if any significant part of those buildings had come down into the what's known as the bathtub, which was this dike actually supporting, keeping Hudson River water out, it would have flooded beneath Lower Manhattan, the most valuable real estate in the world, the subways, path train tunnels. So they had to find a novel way to do it. If Dmitry were right about the three buildings being blown up the same way, you wouldn't have these differences. Plus, according to his theory, when you look at the buildings, and they seem to be coming down, the Twin Towers coming down from the top down, he claims that the first 60 floors is an illusion because they've already been destroyed, and then you got another 20 floors or more that are sort of in a period of starting to break up. And then you have the top floors coming down on top of it. I just did not find it plausible. But here's the thing. That doesn't mean many nukes might not have been used. And they could have been so small, and they could have been arranged a certain way. So that's one of the theories that's going to be approached at the Vancouver hearings. I do appreciate the call.
I have to beg to differ. And with all due respect, I would invite you to reconsider going and looking at his information, because it's quite different to the information that you just put out. And also, I would also invite you to do research on something called Project Plowshare. There are a lot of videos on YouTube that do exhibit the specific phenomenon of what Dmitry has spoken of.
Well, anyone can hear my interview with Dmitry. It's on The Real Deal. Go to radiofetzer.blogspot.com. I can assure you that what I've just explained is exactly what Dmitry said to me.
Okay, and thank you very much, Jim, Greg, everybody for listening. Love you very much. Check out the archives at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.